Russian President Vladimir Putin is in Tehran, meeting with the leaders of Iran and Turkey.
As the West heaps sanctions on Russia and the costly Ukraine campaign drags on, Putin's seeking to bolster ties with Tehran, a fellow sanctions target and a potential military and trade partner.
So, what's the significance of Putin's first trip outside Moscow since the war began?
I think this trip is a sign of weakness. And he's going to Iran in part because he has a weapons problem.
And later in the program, how one Florida resident is using drones to search for pets in war-torn Ukraine. Today is Tuesday, July 19th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. With a worldwide food crisis looming as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin is meeting with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Iran's capital of Tehran, with their sights on reaching an agreement to facilitate the transit of Ukrainian grain through the Black Sea. The Associated Press's Charles de Ledesma starts us off.
As the West heaps sanctions on Russia and the costly Ukraine campaign drags on, Putin's seeking to bolster ties with Tehran, a fellow sanctions target and a potential military and trade partner. In recent weeks, the White House alleges, Russian officials have visited an airfield in central Iran to review Iran-made drones for possible use in Ukraine. But perhaps most crucially, Iran offers Putin a chance for a high-stakes meeting with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who sought to help broker talks on a peaceful settlement of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Last week, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that an important and substantive step was made toward a comprehensive deal to resume Black Sea exports of Ukraine grain after talks between Russia, Ukraine, Turkey, and UN officials completed. Meanwhile, however, Ukraine firefighters on Tuesday rushed to save a burning wheat field with help from local farmers. The emergency service said that the fire in the Mykolaiv region was caused by Russian shelling. Local authorities say that Russian attacks have sparked fires in the southern region of the country, destroying crops that were ready for harvesting. As mentioned just a moment ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin's very first trip outside Russia since Moscow unleashed its war in Ukraine is meant to bolster regional ties. Now, to dive into that topic, I spoke with Ambassador John Herbst, the senior director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, as well as a former ambassador to Ukraine. I began our conversation by asking the ambassador why Putin is making the trip now.
I think this trip is a sign of weakness, and he's going to Iran in part because he has a weapons problem. And the fact that he's seeking weapons from Iran is a very telling marker that, in fact, the war has not gone the way he's expected, and that his vaunted advantage, which is not a false advantage in military equipment, is by no means overwhelming and by no means decisive. The way I describe this, I mean, I'm not a military expert, so people more credentialed than I am in military analysis describe the Russian military as having either the second or the third most powerful conventional force in the world, right? Whether it's China or Russia, we don't know who's second. Well, the second or third most powerful military in the world has been stopped by a country of much smaller size, much weaker military, and with far fewer weapons. And again, the fact that they go hat in hand to the Iranians is an indication of that. So Putin is there to shore up his relationship with Tehran because at this moment he needs their drones. Wow.
And the drones are something that many people think is one of the reasons why he's there. But does President Putin, the Russian leader, need to walk away with anything tangible?
He doesn't need that because, according to the press, Iran has agreed to provide stuff. Now, maybe Iran hasn't provided yet. Maybe that's why he's going. But as far as we know, they've agreed to provide it. Although, you know, the Iranians are tough bargainers. So maybe this trip was part of the deal, too. Who knows? And Putin's fortunate on timing, because this follows, you know, on the heels of Biden's not particularly successful trip, and I'm being kind, to Saudi Arabia. And some favorable to Putin comparisons are already being made. But having said that, this is also a sign of Putin's weakness, that he's going to Tehran at this point.
Putin's also meeting with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, presumably to discuss transport of Ukrainian grain. And Turkey has been really trying to be that go-between, trying to foster some kind of deal that would, you know, see grain being shipped to alleviate some of the worldwide food insecurity that has erupted since the war began. UN Secretary Guterres said that he hoped that a deal could be reached this week. But with Turkey now removing its objection to Finland and Sweden joining NATO, what do you see that as a potential roadblock or having any kind of impact on discussions between Erdogan and Putin?
I can see Putin throwing that in Erdogan's face, but I don't think it has a palpable impact on these talks. It's conceivable, but highly unlikely, that Putin will agree to open up Odessa for the export of Ukrainian grain, because he's facing, at this stage, very little pressure for this additional war crime. The food importing countries refuse to condemn him. They are following at best, blind, non-aligned movement style approach to this developing crisis. And of course, the fact that he's condemned by the West means very little to him. And finally, of course, the Biden administration has been extraordinarily timid on this question. Refusing self-deterring, saying, okay, we can't do that. That's too provocative. They forget that the younger Bush administration simply informed the Russians they were sending humanitarian shipment on U.S. Navy transport into Georgia a few weeks after Moscow's war in Georgia, and with Russian troops still there.
Ambassador John Herbst is the senior director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, as well as the former ambassador to Ukraine. Ambassador Herbst, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
Firefighters in Odessa battled a number of fires in the aftermath of a Russian missile strike on the city. Officials say that at least one person was killed and another six were injured in the attack. Russia's defense ministry said that its forces were destroying an ammunition depot. Joining us from Kyiv with the details is reporter Anna Chernikova.
Over the night, Russian forces fired 7-caliber cruise missiles at the Odessa region. These missiles were fired from the Black Sea. This was confirmed already by the military officials of Ukraine and by the intelligence. So we know that one of the rockets was shot by air defense. However, six others hit the village with no particular military objects or military assets. As a result of this attack, we have a couple of people injured, and also there is a death reported. But again, we are waiting for final confirmation of the numbers later on today. As a result of this attack, three private houses and two civil buildings were destroyed by the Russian missiles. Several private estates and cars as well, and a school and cultural center was also damaged.
And Odessa wasn't the only city that was hit by Russian missiles and artillery. At least one person was killed in the city of Kramatorsk, according to Reuters News, by Russian missiles. What else can you share about the fighting that's taking place in the Donbass as well as other parts in the eastern portion of Ukraine?
So the entire front line is under continuous shelling and intensifying battles where it's reported is in particularly Donetsk region, if we talk about the battles. But the entire front line is under shelling. And over the past days, Russian forces hit missiles over Donetsk, Mykolaiv, Odessa, and Sumy regions. In these areas, a lot of civilian areas were damaged, and a lot of injured people were reported for this period. For instance, for the past day, only in Sumy region, Russian forces fired 150 mines and projectiles over the region. I would remind that Sumy region is a region which is bordering Russia, and this area is constantly under, you know, attacks and under very fragile peace, I should say, because the fightings could always, you know, start because Ukrainian intelligence reports the amount of Russian troops which are moving across the border. So Sumy region is very, very fragile for the moment.
And Anna, as we talk about these attacks in Odessa, in the Sumy region, other places in the Donbass and Ukraine's southern portion, what are military officials saying about the overall state of the conflict? Are either sides making gains?
Yeah, so the situation at the front line in general, if we look at it from south down to from east down to south, is getting under control. And according to Ukrainian commander-in-chief Valery Zeluzhny, during his conversation with the chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, he said that Ukraine managed to stabilize the situation on the battlefield. He also emphasized that the situation is difficult and tense, so we should not, you know, consider this as that peace is coming soon. Unfortunately not, but situation is completely under control, and according to Mr. Zeluzhny. He also mentioned that a very important factor that contributed to Ukraine's retention of defensive lines and positions is the timely arrival of HIMARS systems. And this is definitely what helped Ukraine to deliver targeted strikes on the Russian control points, ammunition, and fuel storage depots.
Anna Chernikova is reporting for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Steve.
A senior Russian security official said on Tuesday that when peace comes to Ukraine, it will be on Moscow's terms. In Washington, Ukrainian First Lady Olena Zelenska met with U.S. First Lady Jill Biden at the White House. That meeting comes a day after meeting U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Zelenska will also address Congress on Wednesday. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. EU officials warned against shrinking European Union support for Ukraine as the bloc's foreign ministers agreed on Monday to earmark $500 million more dollars in military aid to Kyiv and considered banning imports of Russian gold. Lisa Bryant takes it from here.
European Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell warned against what he called democratic fatigue, which Russia would try to exploit.
European societies cannot afford fatigue. The European societies and the European Union member states' governments have to continue standing behind the decisions they have taken. They took the decisions on restrictive measures on the Russian economy, and they have to stick to it.
Borrell insisted energy and other sanctions the bloc has taken against Moscow are working, although experts note Russia continues to rake in billions, selling its oil and gas elsewhere.
The Russian economy is severely affected. Certainly, it's not going to stop the war overnight, but the consequences of the sanctions will create a lot of economic trouble to Russia.
Analysts warn of fading EU support for more tough sanctions amid worries about rising consumer prices and a cold winter ahead with less Russian oil and gas. Germany is also feeling the more immediate fallout of a recent Russian gas pipeline cut, ostensibly for maintenance reasons. Germany's Europe Minister Anna Lehrmann said her country was beefing up its energy self-sufficiency.
We have, from day one of this government, really done everything to become independent from Russian gas. We have built up now renewable energies, energy efficiency, and we are prepared for all kinds of scenarios.
Meanwhile, Foreign Policy Chief Borrell said he was hopeful Kyiv and Moscow could strike a deal to unblock Ukraine grain exports that many poorer countries depend on. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
When Russia invaded Ukraine in late February, many ordinary Ukrainians began helping their military, even if they couldn't fight. Katerina Markova has that story.
Serhii Abramov has been volunteering since Russia invaded Ukraine. At first, he helped with clothes and food. These days, he delivers cars to the front lines.
I started by sending sausages, helping transport food. Then we started sending cars, and everyone was ecstatic. Cars break at the front lines, and when they do, there's no place to fix them.
No matter how many he delivers, the demand remains steady.
We just lost three cars, so there was a need for more. It works this way here. War, what can you do? Someone heard or saw something, and our cover was blown, our car destroyed. I can't say how exactly we're using them, but that's the reality.
Abramov says it takes at least a week to get a car from Europe to the front lines in Ukraine. The car must get a technical inspection and then get repainted, which takes another 2 days. Finding cars to send to the front has gotten more difficult since the war began. Inventory has gone down, and that has pushed demand and prices way up. Abramov's group has delivered more than 10 cars to the front lines, but Serhii says the total number from a coalition of 8 groups is much higher.
I sometimes wonder how we managed to find cars in Europe. We've already purchased thousands, maybe dozens of thousands, all thanks to volunteer efforts and money they raise.
Abramov says money comes from private donations from all over the world. The funds to purchase a car for Spaniard came from orthopedics department of a city hospital in Jesko, Poland.
I've worked as a doctor in Poland for over 3 years now. My employees support Ukraine. Everyone understands that right now, our motherland is protecting all of Europe from Russia. That's why I asked my colleagues to help raise money for a car, and many were happy to help. And so, the Polish Department of Orthopedics bought a car for Ukraine's armed forces. I'm very grateful to my colleagues that we could help the guys at the front.
Volunteer work takes time, energy, and financial resources. But Abramov says it's hard to stop volunteering once you have tried it.
It's an addiction. At this point, it's impossible to say no. It's like a job no one's paying you for. So when people ask you for something, you jump into action and try to help.
Along with cars, Abramov's group is also sending bulletproof vests, walkie-talkies, and other equipment. Katerina Markova for VOA News, Zaporizhia, Ukraine.
Sele Murakezi is the brother of Swede Murakezi, who's a Rwandan-born American who had been living in the southern Ukrainian city of Kherson when he was taken captive by pro-Russian separatists in June. Sele Murakezi spoke with VOA's Central African Service reporter Tim Ishemwe last week.
Thank you for having me on your program. The first time that we found out that my brother was arrested, that was on June 8th, so that was last month. We were basically unable to get in touch with him. We had been in contact with him almost on a daily basis. And on June 8th, he did not pick up the phone. He did not respond to messages. And on June 9th, we learned of his missing by finding a video that was online circulating on pro-Russian media channels.
What did you think happened to him after you saw that video on social media?
We were extremely worried. We were hoping that he was arrested for some reason, but because of what's going on in Ukraine, you know, people are dying every day. We feared the worst could have happened. So our best hope that he had been arrested for God knows what.
When and how did he get there?
My brother started going to Ukraine in 2017, and in 2018, he moved there. So he became a Ukrainian resident. He had been living there since 2018. And that means he did not go to Ukraine to fight or anything like that. But when the war started, the war found him there. He was already living there.
As a family, I understand what you are going through, but what are you doing right now as we speak to make sure that your brother is safe?
From the first day that we learned of his missing, we got in contact with the State Department, and the State Department connected us with the U.S. Embassy in Kiev, and they got all the information about him. We got in contact with the FBI. We got in contact with Project Dynamo. And we also got in contact with our congresswoman. So we have been trying to do everything possible to secure his release.
You say that you have contacted different people and different organizations towards this matter. Have you ever heard anything back from them?
Not exactly. We know that they are doing something, you know, silently. But every time we talk to them, they say that, you know, we are working on it. In most cases, they say that they cannot disclose, you know, information about how they do their work. We believe them. We trust. But Project Dynamo has been very helpful, because for them, they have been able to get in contact with my brother's captors.
Mr. Sele Mulekezi, I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
And I'd also like to thank my VOA Central African Service colleague Tim Nshemwe for sharing that interview. And finally, a Florida man has been incorporating drones into his environmental work for some time. Recently, he found a way to use them to save animals in war-torn Ukraine. Maxim Moskakov wraps it up for us today.
Douglas Throne is no ordinary drone operator. An environmentalist and animal rights activist, he uses his skill to help animals in disaster zones. Using drones equipped with thermal cameras, Throne looks for animals stuck in trees or trapped in debris.
But it was so hard to find them because the debris piles were so big that I decided to put an infrared camera on so that you could see the animal's body heat. And I tried it out and it worked so well that then I ended up doing this all over the world.
Throne equipped his drones with a special projector and a zoom camera. With it, he saved dogs after a hurricane in the Bahamas, koalas from Australian wildfires, and animals in numerous other places from California to the Dominican Republic. But Throne says the war in Ukraine hit him hardest. He spent weeks there, and after a short break back home, will be heading back.
Normally I do fires, tornadoes, and hurricanes. And this Ukraine has been very different because this is a man-made caused, tragedy. It's something that would be avoidable.
Throne works in the hardest hit areas of the Kyiv region. So far, he has saved dozens of cats and dogs. If he can't find the pet's owner, he sends the animal to a temporary shelter.
Right now, we're trying to find the owners. And of course, a lot of them, unfortunately, the owners aren't around anymore. Either that they had to flee, or sadly, we've had relatives reach out and say, yes, I recognize that animal. And can you find it a good home? My whatever relative passed away from the bombing.
Throne took a few cats from Ukraine to Florida with him.
And we were using the drones and we were able to find a mother cat and her kittens 8 stories up in a bombed out building. And unfortunately, you know, pretty much everyone died, except I think the mother cat happened to be nursing its kittens underneath some kitchen, like refrigerator tables and stuff like that in the background. So she fortunately happened to not die. And we found her and rescued her and the kittens.
His friend Ryan Okrand is helping Throne rescue the animals. The men cover all the expenses themselves, but lately have started receiving private donations. Throne started a GoFundMe page to help raise more funds and save more animals.
When we're protecting and saving someone's pet, a lot of times that's all they have left.
Throne's story caught the eye of Hollywood, and his work has been documented in a show called Duck to the Rescue on the Curiosity Stream channel. Maxim Moskalko for VOA News, Washington.
Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage on Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice. of America. Washington, D.C.